Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report, a special weekend edition coming at you on this Easter long weekend. I want to thank everybody for taking some time on this long weekend to join us, and even throughout last week we had a lot of comments and I received a lot of emails again. I really appreciate all those emails from everybody. I am kicking off this show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. And going with the theme of this show, we are going to be talking a lot about this infrastructure bill that was announced this week and some of the market moves, not necessarily this week, but in a bigger picture sense. Jesse, let's start off talking big picture about not just the infrastructure bill, but all these fiscal packages and aid packages that have been rolled out over the last year, not just out of the U.S., but really globally, and not so much a shift, more of an even further acceptance from politicians and even citizens saying that, well, let's just keep on spending. I even have a lot of friends that are saying, yeah, you know, let's just keep on doing this, keep on handing out money. Seems like a bad long-term strategy, but I guess you can make the argument that over the last year, all this spending has helped keep at least some people afloat and some economies afloat. Jesse, where do you stand on really this acceptance towards more spending?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, it represents a paradigm shift in for so many different asset classes and everything. I mean, the Congressional, you know, Budget Office estimated that the fiscal deficit was going to be $2.3 trillion this year versus it was close to $3 trillion last year. But that was before the $2 trillion stimulus that, you know, Congress and Biden passed a month or so ago, or 2 months ago, and before this infrastructure bill. So, I mean, add the $1.9 trillion for the latest fiscal package, and you're over $4.2 trillion this year versus $3 trillion last year in terms of just a budget deficit. And now you're talking infrastructure, and yeah, I think they're talking about raising taxes to, you know, corporate taxes, essentially undoing the Trump, you know, corporate tax cut in order to try and pay for it. But I mean, even if it just adds another trillion, and we're talking over $5 trillion, and that's just massive. I mean, you know, we're looking at, you know, a percent of GDP bigger than anything we've seen, even, you know, World War II or anything. So to me, I just look at this, you know, you know, people are worried about how we're going to normalize, you know, monetary policy. Well, in light of all this, there's no possible way monetary policy can be normalized. There is not enough demand to soak up all the issuance of new debt out there. There's not the natural demand. So the Fed will have to continue printing, if not even increase the amount of you know, debt that they're buying in order to prevent rates from going up. And essentially means that you know, fiscal policy also probably will not be able to normalize very easily, just because people are becoming accustomed to so much stimulus. You know, whether it's checks directly or, you know, the PPP stuff to businesses. You know, people are becoming accustomed to this, and it's going to be very difficult to normalize, because everybody knows there's going to be a major hangover when all of these fiscal packages come to an end. And so there's going to be a lot of resistance to that even happening.
Now, what about where you anticipate all this new money landing? Because over the past decade, a lot of the money that has been printed does end up in the financial markets. Do you see that continuing, or on the back of this infrastructure bill announcement, which will take a fair bit of time, I think, to pass, do you see a bit of a change in where that money will flow?
Yeah, I do think, you know, we saw with the and the stimulus we're seeing this time, the amount of money printing we're seeing just absolutely dwarfs anything we saw in the, you know, during the aftermath or in the height of the financial crisis. It's so much larger this time. But the other major difference is that, you know, so much of this is going into the hands of ordinary people. Fiscal is really taking the reins this time. Last time was monetary policy, you know, the Fed printing a bunch of money to try and support asset prices. This time it's, you know, it's coming from the fiscal side. It's coming from, let's put money into the hands of people, into the tune of, you know, I mean, we're going to be pushing $10 trillion very soon before this is all said and done. But putting money into the hands of individuals is very inflationary. And I think we're starting to see that, or we're going to start seeing it in the headline numbers very soon, but I think we're already seeing it in a lot of areas. I'm seeing it here in Bend where, you know, restaurants are all of a sudden opening up and they're up 30, 40, 50% over a year ago. And they're having a hard time just hiring enough people to keep up with, to be able to stay open. And so I think, yeah, we're going to see inflation really start to take off here, not just due to base effects over the next few months, but I think it's probably going to prove to be more sustainable.
Now, does that mean inflation in the actual government data, or are you going to be looking elsewhere for that inflation? It's an argument that a lot of people have made recently, or well, over the last decade plus, is that the government data just doesn't reflect true inflation, but we do need to consider what different markets move off of as well.
Well, that is a problem, and you know, partly I think the inflation numbers have been depressed here in the U.S., because of, you know, partly what the way it's measured and also partly due to the eviction moratoriums and things like this. So right now, rents are, you know, have been declining in the number, and that does make a significant impact on headline and inflation. But when the rent, you know, the eviction moratoriums are lifted, we should see rents start catching up with home prices, which is already absolutely flying. And so when that reversal happens in the headline numbers, we'll also start seeing, like I said, these base effects, the year over year changes, just because, you know, March, April, May of last year was so depressed in terms of prices that the prices this year are going to be automatically inflationary looking, just because year over year change is going to be so dramatic. But pair that with, you know, a shift in rents, where the rental figures are going to start catching up with home prices. And, you know, there are numbers, like you look at, you know, ISM, non-manufacturing prices paid, these types of things are really good leading indicators of inflation. And they're suggesting we could see 3-4% on headline CPI over the next few months.
Now, is that going to matter because of how big of a disconnect we saw last year with all those shutdowns? The market is expecting this.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, the consensus right now, at least at the Fed and, you know, a lot of MMT proponents and, you know, these types of people believe that this is just going to be transitory, that we're just going to see a big jump in inflation just because of base effects, and then it's going to go away. Now, that's certainly possible, but what I don't think many people really appreciate is that inflation is a very psychological phenomenon, and that it really can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that when people start believing inflation is becoming a reality, they change their behavior. They start buying things, you know, today rather than waiting a month because they believe they're going to be more expensive. And so that shift in inflationary mindset is something that's very, you know, probably impossible to predict, but it's a very significant risk. If people do start noticing, you know, lumber prices and, you know, all these things, and start recognizing car prices, right? Car inventories are another one that are just super low right now. And so car prices are going up. We're starting to see in the consumer sentiment readings, people saying now is a great time to buy these things. So I'm already starting to see this inflationary mindset start to take hold. If it does, then that means inflation becomes, like I said, a self-fulfilling prophecy. People start behaving in a way where that makes inflation more of a problem. And I think all these people that are dismissing the sustainability of inflation are really betting against something that is much more of a possibility or probability than they would like to believe.
Where does that leave central banks and the government? If inflation starts to move higher, even though they have wanted higher inflation for decades now.
Well, you know, to me, I think the all of this that I've been mentioning to me is very, very bullish for gold prices. And it's the irony is just, you know, slapping me across the face right now that literally I couldn't picture a more bullish fundamental backdrop for precious metals. And at the same time, people hate gold right now. You know, sentiment has shifted so dramatically against, you know, gold and silver right now for whatever reason. I look at it as a gift to be adding to positions right now. But really what is the ultimate bull case for gold, and I think we could see this sometime over the next maybe, you know, year or two, is, you know, inflationary pressures pick up. The Fed is forced with a choice to raise interest rates and fight inflation and potentially, you know, crash the stock market in the process. Or say, you know what, the federal government cannot afford higher interest rates. So we can't afford to raise them. So what does that mean? Then they'd have to implement some type of yield curve control and say, we are just going to buy enough treasuries to pin prices at X level, to pin yields at X level. And I think that is a very real possibility. But as soon as the market starts sniffing that out, the gold price will be $1,000 higher than it is today, if not 2,000. So, you know, I think that's coming down the road, just because there's so much new debt being created, and the federal government simply cannot afford higher interest rates. That's probably where we're headed.
Okay, let's carry that over to yields then, and your comment that the government cannot afford higher rates on the back of all this debt. Rates, at least the 10-year, has about tripled in the last 8 months. It was right around 0.5% in August 2020, and now it's over 1.7%. This has continued to fly in the face of a lot of bears saying the market cannot handle higher rates. So far, it has been able to handle those. Where's the balance?
Well, we've been able to handle higher rates, but I think we're going to see the difference. I think is that, you know, if in the past, if we were seeing CPI hit 3 or 4%, like, you know, I said, it could potentially hit over the next few months, you'd see the 10-year at 4, 5, 6%. And there's no way that the 10-year is going to go to 4, 5, 6%. 2%, you know, is already looking like, a short-term ceiling. Like you mentioned, rates have already risen year over year at the fastest rate ever. We've never seen anything like this. It's the worst first quarter for the bond market in a long, long time. And so, you know, rates have already gone up a lot. And I don't think that the Fed, you know, can allow them to go up too much more. And so where we stand now is inflation is going to pick up. And I think in order to be bearish on the gold price right now, you have to believe that nominal interest rates are going to continue to rise faster than inflation over the next few months, which would mean, you know, if CPI doubles, goes up 150 basis points, we'd need to see the 10-year go up 150 basis points, you know, which would put it over 3%. I just don't think that's going to happen. I think that inflation's going to, you know, is almost certain to rise faster than nominal rates going forward. If that's the case, that means real rates are going to come back down again, which is a very bullish backdrop for the gold price. It's that headwind of rising real rates turning into a tailwind once again.
So what about some of the other metals then? You point to gold, but in all fairness, on the back of an infrastructure bill, and even really in the last 8 months, we have seen base metals and battery metals, pretty much every other commodity outside of the precious metals, do very well. We've seen a bit of a pullback here, but copper is still at $4, and that's a pretty strong price for copper. Do you see this inflation that you're expecting creeping into commodities broadly, base metals, battery metals, what have you?
Well, I mean, commodities to me are one of the leading indicators of inflation. Copper is a really good example of that. You know, copper typically leads inflation, by the way I look at it, at, you know, by about 18 months to 2 years, something like that. So, you know, you look at the copper price to me, and it tells me that inflation over the next 18 months, 2 years is on a trajectory that's headed higher. And so, you know, to me, I think a lot of these commodities are essentially the, you know, canaries in the inflation coal mine right now that are pointing to higher headline, you know, inflation numbers that are coming now. So we'll have to watch, you know, what they do from here. Copper's had an incredible, you know, run, you know, as you mentioned. It's just blasted higher over the past 12 months. And it's probably, you know, people are a little over bullish towards it. It's definitely overbought, probably, you know, deserves some sort of a correction before it tries to take out those highs from 2009, 10, 11. And so I think probably due for a rest. But the run that it's had already, to me, is one of those indicators pointing to inflation is coming.
So does that mean, because you say that copper does predict inflation 1 to 2 years out, does that mean we're waiting for 2022, maybe 2023 for this inflation spike?
No, I think it does lead. But if you look at the correlation of the two, you know, core inflation has fallen far lower than where copper, even, you know, over the past few years has suggested it should be. You know, right now, you know, copper, you look at the chart, and if you just, there's a post I recently put up maybe a couple weeks ago, actually it was early March, Dr. Copper delivers a diagnosis of inflation. There's a chart of you know, what I'm talking about here, which is core inflation paired with the 12-month change in the copper price. If you look at this, you know, copper right now is already suggesting core inflation could be 2%, and is generally trending from there up to 2.5 and higher over the next, you know, couple of years.
Jesse, what do you think about battery metals then? There's been a lot of comments and a big move towards kind of this green energy initiative. How do battery metals fit into this overall outlook when you do also combine that infrastructure bill where it does seem like there is a focus on greener energy?
Well, you know, the thing with green energy, and I recently had an extensive conversation on my podcast with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring and Rosenzweig on this mania in green energy stocks. And he's done a fascinating, you know, amount of digging into the green, you know, the revolution towards kind of green energy and things. And what I think a lot of people don't appreciate is just how much traditional energy usage and traditional materials go into green energy. It takes a ton of, you know, energy to produce, you know, these batteries and windmills and solar panels and all of these things. And in the materials required, you know, it's steel, aluminum, nickel, copper. I mean, all of these things. You know, we simply don't even have enough. There's not enough supply above ground right now to meet the demand, you know, that people are projecting for a lot of these things. So I do think, you know, the more we move towards green energy, the more, you know, inflationary it is for the economy. It's just kind of a mathematical fact that if we do want to make this transition, we want to do it sooner rather than later, it's going to, you know, consume a lot of traditional fossil fuels. It's going to consume a lot of, you know, materials. And so that is, you know, something to be, you know, very, very concerned with, I think.
Okay. So overall, I guess the theme here is all this spending you think will finally lead to inflation, and inflation picking up on a much higher level than it sounds like a lot of people or the government is even expecting. Can you summarize how that's impacting your investing strategy and if there's anything that could throw this narrative off?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the risks to the narrative is you know, the fourth wave or whatever they call it in COVID. We're seeing in, you know, India is having a real hard time. Brazil's having a really hard time with the virus right now. And that's certainly going to impact their economies. We saw, you know, in the UK over the last, you know, 3-4 months, you know, they had such a surge and the lockdowns are not good for the economy. You know, Europe is seeing, and we're seeing it in several states here in the US. So it's really a race right now between the vaccine and these variants, you know, the British variant and things that are now endemic in the United States. And so, if we were to lose that race and COVID were to, you know, force us into taking, you know, more lockdowns and things again here in the U.S., it probably, you know, put a damper on those inflationary expectations. But I really do think, you know, we're seeing the vaccine rollout be very effective. We're seeing more plateauing of cases in most problem areas than even new surges here in the U.S. So, you know, I do think the inflationary dynamics are already well underway, and we're going to see them manifest in the next few months. And it has repercussions for everything. It's not just precious metals. You know, rising inflation to me means, you know, pinched corporate profit margins. We're seeing companies, you know, talk about inflationary pressures. There was a great article, I think it was in the Financial Times, how many companies are complaining about rising costs right now. There was one CEO or CFO in particular who, you know, said, we're at DEFCON 4 right now. We have not seen anything like this in his career in terms of the cost pressures they're now facing. So, you know, that is problematic to equities, not just from the standpoint of, you know, rising cost pressures put, you know, pressures on profit margins and, you know, earnings expectations going forward, but also, you know, rising rates, like even in, that we've already seen, you know, do damage to the TINA trade. There is no alternative to owning equities. Well, we're starting to see some attractive alternatives with, you know, rates coming back up. It's not, they're starting to be an alternative to owning equities. So from a valuation standpoint and from a profit standpoint, inflation is very problematic for risk assets.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up here. I'm very curious to see exactly how inflation does actually perk up, or how the money filters through the system to perk up inflation. But you've outlined a number of reasons why you think that will be a key driving factor to watch. It sounds like over a longer time period as well. Jesse, great chatting with you. Again, Jesse is the founder and editor of the Felder Report. I highly recommend checking out his site. And Jesse, we'll chat again in another few weeks. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks, Corey. Always a pleasure.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am in this segment chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog. That's where Mark shares his thoughts on a daily basis on economic data and key market moves. Mark, let's recap some of the key data and news that came out this week that I think we need to take in a bigger context, especially when it comes to the jobs data. The jobs number that was released on Friday, Good Friday, it was strong. We kind of got a taste of that earlier in the week, but there were a little over 900,000 jobs created. That's much higher than the estimate that was a little under 700,000. Mark, is this showing that the economy is coming back, or is this just a simple case of some more maybe low-hanging fruit because stuff is starting to reopen in terms of jobs coming back?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame it. It's not so much that these are new jobs being created. These are basically people returning to their jobs. And so we still are, and like you said, the March jump, over 900,000 jobs were created, people returned to those jobs, and the back months were revised higher. And so in some ways, I think that the data really confirms what we've all known, and that is the U.S. economy is accelerating. And, you know, it still has not gotten back to its 2019 peak, even GDP sizes measures or in terms of employment. But this seems to be a big down payment. You know, the key part of this is the Federal Reserve says that they've linked their bond buying, $120 billion worth of bonds a month, to the what they say, substantial progress towards its targets. And it's not clear exactly, and of course, officials won't be pinned down, what does that substantial progress mean? But what the Federal Reserve is going to find is when they meet in June, the U.S. economy would have created close to 3 million jobs since they met in the and provided their March forecasts. And this seems to be getting closer to what significant progress would be. It still leaves us, at the end of Q1, we still are about 8 million jobs shy of where we were in early January of 2020.
So do you see these jobs eventually being added back? Is this a trend that we're going to be seeing here, Mark, where jobs are continuing to be added back? Because the one problem also with comparing it to where the job market was before the pandemic is that unemployment was very low, right? And we kept hearing that the job market was saturated. Are we going to get back to that level quickly?
I think you're right. You know that on the eve of the pandemic, the unemployment levels were at the lowest in 50 years. And so I think that we're going to reach a point where those the last jobs are going to be more difficult. Partly, you think about what's happening. You know, as if we're going to be bringing back manufacturing jobs to the United States, or that's really like how politicians might phrase it. But what we're really doing is bringing manufacturing to the U.S., and that'll be increasingly automated. I think last year was one of the first years that we saw the robots being bought for outside the that robots outside the auto sector increased faster than the robots being used in the auto sector. And I think this is the future. We're going to be bringing back manufacturing capacity. That's important for all kinds of national economy, national security reasons. But it doesn't mean there's jobs that come with them. And so I would imagine we're going to see that the increase in jobs continues next several months, maybe even through the rest of this year, but then begin slowing down as we reach its own capacity like we did before.
Okay, well, something to keep an eye on, right, is this job pickup, and it really does seem like the U.S. is leading the way. So, again, when you start to come out of these lockdowns, there are a lot of low-hanging jobs that can come online, but it was a good number to end that shortened trading week. Mark, what about this infrastructure bill? Infrastructure was on everybody's mind. We finally got some bill out of the U.S. government, and I think the expectation is it's still going to take a while to pass through all the stages of government, a lot because of the tax increases. But let me just ask you broadly, did anything surprise you, or is anything extra noteworthy about that infrastructure plan?
Well, I'd say two things. One is it's what a lot of people who think of themselves as progressive. That's what the kind of vision they had. They'd want more, but this is like big steps in that direction, including Amtrak, infrastructure, not only the material infrastructure, power grids, highways, bridges, roads, broadband access. So all that very positive, I think. So I think however you want to come down on it, whether it's good or bad, it is a very bold vision, especially given what the state of these conditions is now. But the other thing I'd point out is only half of it. What we've only seen is really one half of this larger infrastructure bill. It's been broken into two parts. And the second part, people aren't talking about yet. Maybe it's a week, 2 weeks away, but it'll be like the other half of this that'll focus on schools. It'll focus on making permanent some other changes that were in the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, earned income tax credits and child tax credits. And as well as expanding health care and expanding family leave. And so two big parts of this infrastructure. One is the material one, and that's what essentially was the what Biden has proposed last week. And then we've got this other one that's still forthcoming. And together, it's still going to look like close to $4 trillion. And even though it's going to be sort of spread out over some of it 4 years and some of it 8 years.
What's the trickle down into the markets, or even more importantly, into commodities? Do you see this infrastructure bill being enough to, A, support the aggressive move we've seen in commodities, and two, drive those commodities even higher?
Well, I think that the interesting thing that what's happening, I think, is that when I look at a lot of the infrastructure, And the move to electric over the fossil fuels, it seems to me that it places a big demand on commodities that the U.S. doesn't have necessarily a lot of. And so on one hand, we all know that the fiscal stimulus is going to create these growth differentials that's going to widen the U.S. trade deficit. But I think this infrastructure bill, should it pass and should it really like begin kicking off, it'll also mean a lot of imports. The infrastructure, we think of people building roads as really domestic, but where are we going to get that asphalt from? We can have the manufacturing build electric devices, but where are we going to get the copper from? And so what strikes me about this, and this is sort of the an interesting framing of what's happened, is that a year ago, when the world shut down because of the pandemic, the commodity prices collapsed. And China looks like they came in and bought lots of commodities, and partly because the U.S. was threatening a trade sanctions, and they were afraid of being isolated, and so they needed to sort of make sure that they had secure supply chains. And secondly, they were astute and used those commodities to also rebuild strategic reserves. And so here the U.S. comes a year later and says, those commodities that China's been buying, you know, we need them too for our infrastructure. But but because of the Chinese buying, prices for a lot of, and the reopening, of course, the commodity prices have already taken off. So the U.S. is not only going to have to import these commodities for the infrastructure bill, but it's going to be paying relatively elevated prices for these compared to, say, where they've been, which is how this commodity super cycle story is still being fanned. And you can see this in a lot of the buy-side research.
So do you think then, even though commodities are broadly higher in price, do you think that means commodities continue to run higher? Or has China stepped back enough that the balance then just shifts to the U.S. to hold these prices?
Well, I think that's the thing, is how China is really the swing buyer. And so the things that I've been seeing and reading lately make it seem like China has backed off. But it's not clear why they've backed off. Has their strategic reserves reached levels that they want? There's not a lot of transparency. Or is it that higher prices, and it's just like, why other people might be back off a little bit from chasing commodity prices higher. So I don't really have a lot of transparency on it, but I do suspect that there is a larger like game being played out, and it's not just about U.S. infrastructure, but it's also how the rest of the world responds. If you're a producer, maybe you'd want to also, if you're in Taiwan, or in Japan, maybe you too would want to build up strategic reserves. And I think we want to consider this as part of this broader effort to rethink globalization and what we need to do for ourselves. How much do we need to be sufficient in, and how secure are those supply chains?
How much does this infrastructure bill, if passed, just go to further support the argument that governments and central banks are not afraid of continuing to keep printing money? And that is truly the story here, is that it doesn't matter what kind of bill they put out, governments want to keep on spending.
Yeah, so I do think that there is a strong push in the U.S. I also think it's fairly popular. They're not just being like government doing it, but people are sort of, I think, are quite in favor of it, like you would in general, right? But I don't think it's generally shared like this. So, for example, I think that we'll see many countries, including the Eurozone and Japan, show smaller budget deficits this year than they did last year. And so that's one of the reasons why I think the Canadian dollar is fairly resilient, that Canada and Norway are probably the leading candidates to pull back from some of the stimulative measures. In fact, next week, one of the highlights will be Canada's jobs data. And another robust report, I think, will sort of fan the expectations that the Bank of Canada changes its forward guidance on its buying of $4 billion dollars worth of federal bonds a week. And so I hear what you're saying. Countries are still reluctant to pull back a lot of the stimulus, And when they are pulling back the stimulus, they're sort of like, just like sort of very little. And I think that, I think people and policymakers are really scared by what happened last year and want to make sure that the economy is strong and don't want to pull away the punch bowl too early.
Do you think we are broadly seeing stronger economies, though? Is that going to continue to be the trend? Not just reopening, but actually stabilizing some of these economies at higher levels?
Well, that I think is a part of the problem, right? Is I think that we could return to, everybody wants to, oh, it was in 2019, can we just get back there? And I think that the underlying challenge will remain, and that is how to really, when you have aging populations that have already been urbanized, you've got like a very wide dispersion of durable goods like cars, refrigerators, stoves, how to keep growth strong. You've got slower population growth. And I think we fall back into that, back into that with slow population growth, slow household formation is a return to slow growth. And this fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, it acts as a bit of a sugar buzz, but it has a finite life to it, even if we don't know exactly how long.
Yeah, that's fair. But it still sounds like there's a bit of a sugar high then for these economies. Is that fair to say that we can continue to expect at least all this easy money to somewhat support the reopening trade?
I think so. I think that we're going to see it. It's going to be stretched out too, because it's not really coordinated among the major countries. So for example, by the time that the U.S. fiscal stimulus begins wearing off and some of the programs like the extension of unemployment benefits expires, that'll probably be around the time that the European stimulus, fiscal stimulus, the EU's recovery fund can begin allocating funds. And so, and there'll be reverberations back for U.S. companies who operate in Europe from a stronger European economy. So I think this could be stretched out, and I do think we're in for this phase of very strong growth, Q2, Q3 of this year, maybe a little bit weaker in Q4. The year-over-year comparisons will be more difficult, of course, and I think some of the U.S. fiscal stimulus will begin wearing off. So that's why I think the next 2 quarters, 6 months, we'll have, I think, a very strong world economy. Partly the markets are anticipating it, but partly we also still trade off of headlines.
Yeah, you're right. That's what the volatility aspect is. But it sounds like reopening still on everyone's mind and still progressing, which, I don't know, to me means that the broad markets will still be supported and those calls for major crashes or a major correction still seem maybe a little premature. But we'll see how it all plays through the system because, as I've mentioned throughout the week, there are more lockdowns and restrictions that came into Canada. So it is not a smooth line for all countries, but the U.S. does seem to be leading the way. Mark, I appreciate your time. I hope that you have a very happy Easter and a good long weekend. Thanks for your time this weekend, Mark.
Thanks a lot. Good luck, everybody.
Welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am introducing a new guest to the weekend edition. However, I have chatted with this individual and posted some of his articles over the last about month and a half now. I'm happy to report that I am chatting with Doc Jones. He is a private investor. As I mentioned, he has shared some of his research reports on some of the companies that he likes, ranging from resource companies to a recent energy or oil company that he shared with us. I have received a lot of very positive feedback on the back of Doc Jones' interview, so that's why I'm featuring him on this weekend show. Now, Doc Jones, we are going to jump around to a number of different topics, but I know a lot of our listeners do want to hear your thoughts on gold. And what I want you to outline is, look, the fact of the matter is gold continues to correct. It's now over 7 months, almost 8 months long of a correction now. What are some of the major factors that you think are contributing to this pullback?
Hey, Corey, thank you for having me back. I think there's a number of factors that some investors may be overlooking if you look at the broad picture of things. If you start with the IMF, have come out with their forecasts for this year and next year of GDP growth. And you have what's happened because of COVID, that you have the business cycle has been reset for every country, and every country is expanding at the same time. The last time that we had this kind of robust growth was after the Second World War. So we're looking at a great time in the economies, which means there isn't any fear out there, right? There will be inflation in the system, but primarily that will be in energy and base metals and materials. And if you're a gold miner right now, if you look at the cost inflation on your inputs, you compared to last year, because investors generally compare to the year before. You have oil prices from last year that have doubled. You have timber prices that are up 400%. You have steel prices at multi-year highs, aluminum prices at multi-year highs, interest rates that are higher, labor costs, which are going up. And you have a gold price that has declined compared to the last year. So margins are being severely compressed, as well as you have the 10-year treasury that is rising consistently. And they've been recently floating in the media about a 3% on the 10-year to see how the market will respond to that. And so far favorably. And part of that too, that you need, that I personally think that we'll get a 10-year treasury at 3% within the next 12 to 18 months, because the Federal Reserve needs a tool for when we do go into the next recession to bring us out of it. And historically, that has been at least 300 basis points of cutting of the rates. And they're not going to go to negative on the rates. In real terms, you can have negative interest rates, but the U.S. is not very motivated to go less than zero on their 10-year. So these are all the factors that are lining up against gold's favor. And there's no fear out there. Why would anyone be afraid when you're looking at one of the greatest economic expansions that we've had in decades, right? And if you have a mind, your input costs are just rising. And people are looking forward and they're seeing, okay, higher interest rates, no fear, lots of economic expansion. So the trend for the gold price is lower.
Yeah, that's very true, Doc. And one other thing that I want you to elaborate on here is that your comment there, margins are getting compressed, even as some of these miners are building up some nice cash positions. But as you said, the market's forward looking, right? And their costs keep on escalating while their product is actually declining in price. So this could be a very key factor as to why the large investors have more or less shied away from the sector.
Yeah, especially if you look at their highest input costs, which tend to be energy, and some of the forecasts out there, Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, other places looking at a $70 to $80 oil price. You know, for all those mines that run off of diesel generators for their power, and especially open pit mines, it's a double whammy, right? You suddenly, your mine was profitable at, say, $1,700 gold. Your margin is 20%. Well, the gold price declines 10%, or $100. You were making $200 an ounce. Now you're only making $100. But then you factor in these other factors of cost inflation on the input side, and you could have negative cash flow, right? So the bar gets raised as what's profitable, not only because of the declining gold price, but the increase of the inputs. So and those are hard things to model, because we don't know what could happen potentially with, for example, the energy price, which is one of the largest inputs. If we do get some kind of parabolic spike in energy because of shortages, then that's not something that people want to participate in. And you see it, you know, juniors will come out with a great drill result and they will sell off on it. Whereas last year, when I was 100% precious metals, by the way, I am by no means, I do love gold. You know, I'm not someone who says, oh, gold is a worthless asset. I think it's a very valuable asset. And it has it's done its job over the last few decades of maintaining its purchasing power. But currently, there's more risk on the downside than to the upside. And with the higher interest rates, that kind of absorbs any growth in money supply or inflation that you'll see in the gold price, where the inputs will be rising faster than the increase in the gold price, leading to declining margins. And this happened last time in the bull market towards the end for gold, where even though the gold price was $1,700, $1,800, $1,900, the margins were compressing because the input costs were rising quicker than the price of what they were selling, the gold price, right? So that's kind of the balancing act. You know, if your inputs are rising faster than you can increase your prices, then that's not a recipe for success.
You are correct on that one. Doc, one other quick question regarding yields. As you mentioned, that there has been the whole 3% yield floated in the market. You talk to gold bugs, though, and they're saying the market, the system can't withstand higher interest rates because look at all the debt in the system. That will cause this big collapse and rush people into gold. You clearly don't follow that mindset.
Well, it's frankly not true. You know, they can print as much money as they want, right? That's a reality, right? The money supply has grown exponentially, but is the world still turning? Are economies still running? They are, right? So there's not a direct correlation of money supply growth to the rise in gold price, right? So that's really as simply as I can put it, you know? And when yields rise, it also makes it less attractive to invest or hold gold because gold doesn't pay a coupon. Or if you can get 3% or on a 30-year at that time, if you got 3% for the 10-year, maybe the 30-year is paying 4.5%. So people will gravitate towards that.
So, Doc, I'm a bit worried to ask you this question, but do you think the gold bull market is over?
Well, I don't think it's over. I think with the amount of expansion going on globally that will take place over the next 2 years, I think I've prepared my portfolio. I still hold, I have about 20% in gold equities, but they're just ones that have a mineable resource at 1500 gold, that have a resource, right, that I can quantify and say, well, this company's trading for, you know, $10 an ounce in the ground, they're cashed up, and they have an excellent team, and they have the potential to bring in a resource greater than 3 million ounces, right? Because that's what the market needs now. They need a resource at least 3 million ounces for a major or mid-tier to want to acquire. And, you know, there's many different metrics. Also, you know, like Cassiar Gold, for one, their last drill program, their finding cost per ounce was around $2. And that's relevant because they already have a resource. It's mineable. If it was just they found 100,000 ounces on its own, who cares how much it costs them to find it? Even if it costs them $1, no one's going to start a mine for 100,000 ounces. But they have about 1.5 million ounces now, you know, which could be a small mine on its own. And they have the opportunity to possibly expand that beyond 3 to 5 million ounces once they start drilling the Table Mountain, where they have a high-grade epithermal system there. So I don't think the bull market is over, but I think the next 2 years it will underperform, or a year and a half. Once this stimulus wears off and the market will start demanding higher rates, rates will have to climb until something breaks. And after things break, then the period after that, after we are in a recession, they start cutting rates, that's when gold will start performing again.
Okay, so there's a time frame for everybody. I wish it was a little bit more optimistic, but I don't disagree with you there, Doc. You do outline a number of very valid reasons. Let's talk about some sectors that you are interested in then. The last time we chatted about the oil price, energy broadly, but especially oil. Oil has pulled back a little bit, but still is at these relatively higher levels than where it was for the last, well, little while, over a year now. Doc, how do you still feel about the oil sector?
Yeah, I think it's the best value in the market right now, especially the Canadian oil sector. Like, there are companies trading out there. Their free cash flow multiple, they're trading. They could essentially, keeping their production flat where it is and keeping the current prices flat, within 3 years, buy back all their stock and all their debt. It's just there's just such a great value out there, and there's a lot of tailwinds for the gold, not for gold, the oil sector. You know, you've got, as we've talked about before, you've got the U.S. has a policy now against expanding production or having drilling on federal leases. They're basically doing everything they can to curb shale production in the future. You have the North Sea, the UK, talking about banning new leases in the North Sea, which is going to limit future production. You have OPEC, which is limiting production. And then you have this great economic expansion, and GDP growth is directly correlated to energy consumption. And the highest growth year over year in GDP are in countries or in the less developed world, where they tend to use a lot more fossil fuels, China and India, which classically use a lot of fossil fuels as far as energy. So, I'm just pulling something up here now, you know. Oh yeah. Like there's a, like one of my, if I talk about a company, chances are I own it, like this offhand. Like I do own Cassiar. I own i3 Energy, which I will talk about. That originally when analysts did their report on this company, they did it in November when oil prices were $39 a barrel. And for the year, they had the free cash flow of $17 million U.S. Now, at today's oil price, their free cash flow, the oil price has gone up about $20 a barrel, but their free cash flow has increased 100%, right? And at $70 a barrel, their free cash flow, it would take them, their free cash flow yield would be 62%, which means that they could buy back all their debt, all their stocks in less than 2 years. You know, and there's a lot of companies in Canada like that.
So is it a Canadian focus then? Because the Canadian oil companies have really lagged.
Yeah. I think they're the best value because they've always been the most conservative with their debt as compared to their U.S. counterparts. People forget that the reason why we've had such great economic growth in the last decade was at the expense of shale. Shale was basically uneconomic, but the United States pumped so much money into it to keep the price of oil low, to satisfy demand, so that they could experience high economic growth and the rest of the world could. Otherwise, we would have ended up in a protracted recession, basically, because of high energy prices. You know, the discovery of shale, being able to get oil out of the source rock, took the United States from being a net importer to a net exporter and satisfied demand in the market that otherwise wouldn't have been there. Supply in the market that wouldn't have been there, you know. So, and in Canada, like they're starting to export, build capacity to export to not only the United States, which is historically was like their number one market, but to get it to China, to India, to the UK. And they have the advantage of their fixed costs are in their local currency, which is Canadian dollars, which is about at a 30% discount to the U.S. dollar, which they sell their product in. Plus, there had been historically a lot of differentials, high differentials for like Edmonton sweet crude. It used to have like a $10, $12 differential against WTI, which means if WTI was $60, they would only get $48. But now those differentials are almost gone away, where the differential is like only $2 because there's such a lack of supply right now, and more capacity has been built to get that oil to market. It's really, really quite a great time. Like, you know, some of the number one performing stocks in my portfolio in the last year have been in the oil sector. There's been many of them that have gone up 500-700%. And they experienced the same kind of free cash flow growth that the gold producers did at the beginning of the cycle last year. Whereas you've got a lot of producers that were just capturing a very small margin. Say when oil was, you know, $40, that they're only earning $8 a barrel. But then oil at 60, suddenly their margins have expanded 400-500%, you know, and the cash flow just compounds immensely. and they pay dividends too. You know, it's nice to own something that's growing double digits, that has no debt, and is paying you a 3-5% yield that is growing, right? Plus, Canada also, there's a new play that was discovered in 2018, the Clearwater oil play up in northern Alberta, where it is the most economic play in North America in the Tier 1 area and in the Martin Hills area of the Clearwater play. The IRRs there on the oil wells that they drill there exceeds 1,000%. They pay it. Those wells pay out in 7 weeks, and they cost like $1.2-1.3 million to drill. And then in the Tier 2 areas where the company I invest in, it has acreage there, those wells, the IRRs on them are like 400%. They pay out in 6 months, you know, and then they and these are conventional wells. So there's no fracking. They don't use thermal to make the oil flow. They're just open hole completions, and the oil just flows naturally. You know, it's really incredible. Like, there's so much money to be made up in Canada right now, and it's so overlooked.
Okay. Hey, Doc, I appreciate these insights. And look, I know the pressure on gold is shying some people away, but there are some opportunities elsewhere in the resource sector. And oil, it's something that we had talked about, but sharing some of your thoughts and some of the really data, the fundamentals, why you like these companies, it does make a whole lot of sense. I look forward to having you back on the show again soon, Doc, and I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. Please keep all the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you, and I especially love hearing your thoughts on the companies that I am bringing on the show. I'm starting to make a bit more of a push, too, to bring on some other resource companies, so please, everyone, let me know what you think of those companies and any questions that you have. It really helps me follow up with those companies and get your questions answered. Doc, Jones, everyone else, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend and a very happy Easter to everybody this weekend.
Thank you, Corey. You as well.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.